Yeah.
Okay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present
Hello and welcome to GIST Radio. We are a casual radio station where we broadcast when we have something to say. GIST stands for Getting Your Shit Together, and we broadcast important interviews and information for artists and creatives of all kinds. For more information on GIST, please log into our website at www.gyst-ink.com, where you will find free resources, software, and publications for artists. You can email to let us know what you would like to hear about at info@gyst-ink.com. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome to Creative Orange County, the radio show where we interview Orange County, California, and sometimes L.A., and a number of times, creative stars, artists, entrepreneurs, angel investors, CEOs, nonprofit leaders. My name is Susan, and I will be your host today. We've got a sunny day here in California. The weather broke a little. We had some 100 temperatures last week, but I know with tornadoes and wildfires, that's really kind of like nothing. I have a very special guest joining me today. Mildred Lewis is a dynamic and articulate woman, and let me give you a little bit of background on her before we start asking her some questions. It's Mildred Inez Lewis, and she began her career as a theater director at the Actors Studio in New York, and I know that's very famous, even though I'm not that well connected to film and television or theater. She earned an MFA in film and television at UCLA, so she obviously came here. Her screenplays and plays have been produced and screened internationally. And now she's at Chapman University's Dodge College of Film Media Arts, and she's been there since 2000. And last year, she actually began teaching film and digital humanities in Chapman's English department. So she does have a title of, assistant professor in the English department. And this year, she's also going to serve as a university faculty mentor, and maybe she'll tell us something about what that involves. In 2009, she co-founded the Fox Lewis Project, a production company, and in this year, in 2011, the project produced viral content for HBO's True Blood, and I know that's very, very popular show, and projects for corporate clients, including M Urgent and IM equals X Pilates. She has served as a juror for the CINE Golden Eagle, Short Subject, and Eastman Kodak's International Film Competition. And from 06 to 08, she served on the advisory board for FilmYourIssue.com. She's also a board member of the University Film and Video Association. So just kind of stellar film and video credentials, and we are so very pleased to welcome Mildred today.
Thanks so much for having me, Susan, and good morning or good afternoon or good evening to the listeners who are listening throughout the day.
Well, thank you. And Mildred, tell us about, let's start with this maybe early career in theater, because that kind of set the kind of the tone for your career and kind of subsequent work. So let's talk about that.
You know, theater is a terrific place to start. I was very, very fortunate at Oberlin University College, where I went to do both a degree in cello and a degree in economics, of all things. Yeah, that's how I started. I did the economics because, you know, my parents were worried that I would starve. And, you know, I was a musician. I wanted to be a classical orchestral conductor. And I found that path difficult. And to make a living, I began directing pit orchestras. So I directed the orchestra for Chorus Line, Off-Broadway, and Kiss Me, Kate, and all kinds of musicals. And I found that I loved working in the theater. You know, I love the people, I love the camaraderie, but I wasn't really thrilled with the musical comedy sort of genre and the musical theater genre. I liked it, but I didn't love it. And then I started directing plays, and I just fell in love.
Wow. And then from there it's so interesting to hear just where sometimes individuals started, you know, especially with a bachelor's degree in, you know, cello and economics, and just kind of like, you know, where you've moved and how your, you know, career has transformed, you know, from that and where it started and the key points,
taking
all those gags. So then you came out here to UCLA for film and television.
My dad was a film chemist. Okay. And he was a member of SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers, and presented technical papers and worked on really, really big pictures like Cleopatra and so forth. Oh. So I think it's kind of natural that we don't want to do what our parents ask us to do. And it's sort of interesting that I traveled all around the world to get back to, you know, the love that I had with four movies with my dad.
Oh, how wonderful. And so coming out here, just kind of with the trajectory of your career, and how did you get to Chapman and to teach?
Sure. I went to UCLA. I came to Los Angeles in sunny Southern California without a car, so I was pushing around 16-millimeter film equipment all over Westwood and Palms and Culver City in a little Vons cart. Vons is our local supermarket here in Southern California. And I just got really tired of pushing the cart. I mean, I did well. I mean, I got a Guggenheim Award for my documentary work and an Apple Computer Award for my documentary work and did short films. But I really turned to writing, and I just fell in love with it. I was very fortunate to win a Golden Award, a Samuel Golden Award for my screenplays, and that really launched my career in terms of writing for film and television. I was freelancing. I mean, I had several features produced on Bowed, Bald Chick, which was a sci-fi post-apocalyptic thriller, and then I was working for Disney, and then I got this opportunity to teach, and it happened at a really, you know, important turning point in my life. My mom was ill, so I was going back and forth to New York a lot, and teaching gave me the opportunity to keep doing what I loved, to share what I loved with people who were up-and-comers, and also have that flexibility to take care of family.
Oh, terrific. And so, you know, you've done that now, you know, and you know, with the English department, and this year you're going to be a university faculty mentor. So what does that mean in the kind of the university environment?
You know, this is, you know, this is an awesome honor from the chancellor's office and my colleagues. You know, they selected four university faculty fellows for their excellence in teaching and their impact on the university. And we get an opportunity to design projects to help our colleagues become better teachers. My focus is going to be on how to use digital in the classroom and also how to teach in such a way that we're reaching kids who grew up with iPods and iPhones and don't remember the days of card catalogs and libraries and only know Google. And that's really exciting to me because that sort of intersection is where I live.
And so what does that mean? Because I've taught, and I know that's and obviously went to school at a different time when they didn't even have computers. I have to admit that. But just what does that mean for, you know, teaching? I know it's really just changed so dramatically in how you present material and how you engage the students. So what's that going to be about?
I think we start with realizing that they process information in a completely different way. When you realize that YouTube is the number two search engine in the world, that means that our kids don't necessarily think in terms of searching for text. It means that they think in terms of pictures, and they put things together in that way. They make connections between things in an interdisciplinary way naturally, in a way I think that more traditionally trained people do not. And I think we have to sort of develop our teaching so that we help them to get the good things from traditional education, the ability to focus, the ability to think critically, but we build on the skills that they already have.
And so what kinds of mediums would you use in the classroom and just, you know, are most faculty, you know, embracing, you know, the change and how to present the material or, you know, is there some kind of, you know,
kickback? Oh, absolutely. We meet with them where they are. I mean, I'm going to be showing colleagues how to use Twitter in the classroom and how to use TweetDeck to help to do primary source research. If you're familiar with QR codes, QR means, of course, quick response. And those
right.
are those strange-looking codes that we sometimes see where you can point your mobile phone at it and it'll give you more information.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes having them design QR codes that help to explain complex projects. I'm, for instance, having my students do a project on St. Augustine. You know, the great scholar from the 400s who wrote the Confessions and City of God. And they're actually developing QR codes to lead an elementary school through who the key philosophers are. So they're actually doing a virtual tour for them. And by doing that, they got over the pain of reading something that's translated in Latin. And they're having a blast, but more importantly, they're engaging one of the key Western minds of all time. But they're doing it through the technology. You know, our expectations don't change in terms of excellence, in terms of critical thinking, in terms of rigor, but I think the means that we use to get there have to change, and we have to account for people who don't have attention spans that are as long as ours were.
Absolutely. So our brain, has been changed by the internet. In fact, I have a book which I haven't read thoroughly through that actually came from a TED. Is the internet changing the way you think? Edited by John Brockman, and it's a full of essays by different individuals that, on that subject. So you would say yes.
Yeah, I've read that book, and it's terrific. I mean, I think we can go too far with it. I don't think the brain is sort of in some drastic new level of evolution, but we do think differently, and we do put things together differently. I think it's, trying to sort of serve distracted students is really important. I had a student who was falling asleep in a graduate seminar, and he had his laptop only partially open. He couldn't possibly have read the screen, but it was amazing, Susan. He actually kept tapping the screen every time it went to sleep. Because he's so used to having that blue light shining.
Mm-hmm.
And, we have to develop techniques that don't penalize them for that, but take the strengths of what they have, which is, again, being able to pull together a lot of information quickly. And we have to teach them judgment. We have to teach them wisdom. But, to give you two practical examples,
sure.
What we call jigsawing, which is where we break information down into smaller modulars or bits, and allow the students to draw connections with it, and then we help them get to a point of being able to pull it together in a rigorous way, is much more effective than traditional lecturing for this generation. So it's much more of an active teaching-learning process. It's about integrating media along with traditional tools. I think we'd be remiss if, we didn't have sort of the old-fashioned butt-to-seat time where people were just sitting and really thinking deeply about something. But that's not the natural bent for today's student, and so we have to develop that skill while we draw upon skills that they have that we don't have.
Interesting. Wow, how fun. And how long will you be a university faculty mentor? Is it a 2-year or 1-year type of position? Or
there are two mentors who are terrific. My colleagues Lee Estes and Joanne from Communications. They're going to be doing a year long, and I'm going to be doing a half year. Two of us are going to do half a year.
Okay.
So I'm really excited about it because, the thing is that this is an opportunity to turn learning into a real dialogue, because we have colleagues who don't really know the technology as well as their students, are afraid of the technology, but at the same time have mastered the discipline in a way that our students couldn't possibly have had. So it really gives an opportunity for a respectful, kind of very deep exchange, where I think you're going to start to see more faculty-student collaboration, not just at Chapman, but at all universities. As things start to equal out and, as over time more faculty are tech savvy and start to sort of reach the level that the students are at.
Oh, absolutely. Now, you've gone on in 2009. I mentioned that you co-founded the Fox Lewis Project as a production company, and you're doing some very interesting things, with that, again, with kind of film and digital and internet and television. So let's talk about that and just, True Blood, I know. I'm not quite a vampire, right? It is vampire.
It is vampire.
Completely ignorant on the subject. But I know it's really very, very popular. So tell us, what you're doing with that.
We are, still a relatively new company. I co-founded it with my former student, Adam Fox, and it's really a terrific example of what we were just talking about. I mean, he's a young Jewish man from North London. I'm a middle-aged black woman from Harlem, USA, who's now a proud, resident and worker of L.A. and a resident most of the time of the Orange County, axis. And so sort of diversity and technology are really at the core of who we are as people, and integrating that. So we've done a wide range of corporate projects. HBO's True Blood was something that was really a great experience. We produced actually staged vampire kills. So at iconic L.A. areas that people wouldn't necessarily associate with traditional tourism. So in Little Tokyo at Doc Waller State Beach, which you may know is one of the few state beaches that still allows bound fires in California.
Okay.
Griffith Park. And, it was terrific. I mean, we had actors, we scripted it. The content lived on the website for one of the characters in True Blood. And it was called Vamp Kill, and also appeared on one of the episodes. So it was
a
terrific opportunity.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
No, I just, so that's a whole, and I know Mildred's going to speak at TEDx SA Artist Village, which is Saturday, October 1st, and we don't want to give her TED Talk completely away, but I think we want to talk more about just what's happening with the integration kind of television with the Internet, and maybe you can speak to that, you know, what's happening in other examples.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the way that I got introduced to this was through the Producers Guild. I was selected for their producing workshop, and it was, you know, we got to hear industry leaders in all different areas. And to be honest with you, I'm a traditional kind of storyteller. I mean, you know, in terms of writing and directing, I started at the Actors Studio, which is really kind of classic American theater, if you think of Stella Adler and Elia Kazan and so forth. And I use the Internet, and I love technology always, but, you know, I hadn't really thought about the implications for what it would mean for us as directors and writers. We heard Laurie Schwartz, who is now the chief technology officer at Mechanic Ericsson, talk about a program that some of your listeners may know called Ghost Whisperer.
Okay,
and Ghost Whisperer
yeah.
is a very, very popular show that ran for many years on CBS. It starred Jennifer Love Hewitt. And we got an opportunity to see how they made that show successful. And I'll just break it down to you in three little parts to give your audience a sense of the complexity. Ghost Whisperer's challenge was being a very young show, or a young skewing show because of its star and its content, on what is traditionally an older, more rural network. So the question was, how do we make a home for this show, which we think is a great idea, which is wholesome, it's got, you know, terrific themes, you know, for people who may not initially be engaged by the content, and also how do we engage younger viewers who weren't necessarily traditionally, with the exception of Survivor, CBS's base. And the producers of the show actually created their own website, and it was just remarkable to go through this case study and to realize how deeply the producers were engaging the viewers. It went way beyond just traditional fandom and suggestions to the point where they were creating sub-characters and sort of webisodes, which are short stories that are derivative from the main story on the site. And that's when I began to really understand that, you know, the dialogues that were possible because of the Internet and Web 2 really changed the dynamics of storytelling, because it's no longer sitting around a fire, you know, sort of saying once upon a time. Now it's about really integrating and thinking about people who are deeply engaged in your content. At the same time, I think that's very challenging because, you know, we're master storytellers, and the idea of integrating other people's ideas, you know, it goes beyond traditional collaboration, because in traditional collaboration, really the central vision is being aided by your collaborators, your production designers and so forth. But all of a sudden you have viewers who are suggesting story ideas, you know, and a lot of times people are taking those ideas, and to remain relevant and to remain vital, you know, you have to at least engage with those things. And so I was really interested in what that meant. The final thing is that now we're in a generation where people are watching things across platforms, so that I might watch Ghost Whisperer on my mobile device, I might watch it on my television set, I might watch it, you know, on a larger screen in a home theater environment. And so thinking through the challenge of what does that mean to create stories and characters that could live across what have traditionally been considered very different kinds of media. So those are the two things that I'm sort of very excited to talk about and think about in our own practice at the Fox Lewis Project. And just as people who are watching this incredible, you know, fast-paced change.
Oh, and I just, you know, I have to say, you know, Mildred and I sat down maybe a month or so ago, and she initially explained this idea of, you know, how story has changed. And it's, you know, it's just not something that I had thought about before, but it's really, it's just fascinating. And how is it different? I mean, just maybe very basically, you know, how is it different, you know, over like mobile and home theater and what? Can you just, you know, relate just a couple examples?
Oh, absolutely. For one thing, the technology is very different. The interface on mobile devices, whether you're talking about an Android or an iPhone or a BlackBerry, requires a really different kind of optimization. And if you think about it, what it takes to view something credibly on a 3-inch or a 1.5 screen, you know, you obviously can't take what was on television and just slap it on there. You obviously can't take what was meant to be seen on a 13 or 15 or 17-inch computer screen and slap it on there. So those things have to be rethought. So that if you think about traditional filmmaking, you know, that's a decision that we make early on, whether we, you know, the aspect ratio, how wide is that rectangle, you know, how narrow is it. But now we have to think all the time about this kind of mutability, this ability to change and still have our content have the same impact. Another thing that, you know, that we think about all the time are characters. You know, the kind of characters that traditionally were well-received on television were the kind of characters that you feel comfortable seeing week after week. So that there's a kind of intimacy that you have with a television star that you couldn't have and really probably wouldn't want to have with a film star. But now that we're talking about stories that have to translate across media, transmedia, and we might be telling a continuation of that story, we might be branching it out, or we might indeed want somebody to be able to live in U-verse, where they're sort of watching it in their home, hopping in, watching in their car, and then finishing it up on a computer screen at work. Now we have to think very differently about characters because, again, the scale of those characters and the depth and complexity were traditionally very different and conceived of very differently, and now we have to begin to think about how they can work across the media, and I think the real shocker here is that we don't control it.
Mm.
You see what I mean? Actually, the viewer decides, you know, whether they want to see it on a mobile or whether they want to see it on a film screen. They decide whether they want a fractured experience. So, in other words, they want to watch it as they travel through their day or they want to sit down and watch it in whole in one kind of environment. And so just thinking through that and how it can make sense for them and how it can still be vital and still engaging is really a challenge. I wonder sometimes if we'll solve it in this generation or if it's the next generation of kids who grew up with iPhones who will really be able to use it to its full potential.
Oh, God. It's just absolutely fascinating. My mind is, like, just actually exploding. So, folks, she's kind of giving her, she's almost giving her mini TED Talk, which you'll hear more of if you come on Saturday, October 1st. So it's really fascinating. But now, I mean, you're involved with, you know, the Fox Lewis Project and your production company, but you also serve as a juror for some film competitions and festivals. And just tell us about that, and are you, you know, what are you seeing, you know, maybe differently that you you didn't see, you know, 5 years ago as, you know, entries? Has there been a change?
Well, one thing is, I think is really important to say up front. I think it's critical for people in the business to reach back and to take these opportunities to serve as jurors, to serve as mentors. I don't know what it is about the entertainment business, but it attracts just a gosh-awful number of kind of leeches. You know, people who are make their money from giving people, you know, really questionable advice. And I think that when people are in our competitions, when they are in juried panels, they get an opportunity to talk to professionals, to professors, filmmakers, and to get some really good advice, some sound advice, particularly in an environment that's changing so dynamically. We really need to have continual conversations about what's really going on and getting a handle on that. So I just have a passion for that, so I wanted to say that. In terms of what we're really seeing, we're starting to see, you know, it's sort of two different things, and I think they're sort of what you would expect. On the one hand, we have an absolute explosion globally in terms of what's going on with documentary. That's in large part driven by the new technologies, the fact that we have cameras like the RED, cameras like the Canon, that can begin to give us almost cinematic quality, cinematic quality images without the price and without the large crews that we used to need. I mean, even when you compare the Canon, I mean, I'm blown away by the kind of images that we can get and how portable they are and how accurate they are and how high quality the resolution is, even from 5 years ago. And so that means that you can make films like, say, A Born Into Brothels, you know, which was set in, you know, an unfortunate region in India where there were children of the prostitutes who work in the red light district. You could never have gone in there with a 35-millimeter camera set up, you know, because it was illegal to shoot there, and you needed to be mobile, you needed to be quick, you needed to be fast, you needed to be able to shoot in low light. So that's one thing, is that there's just this explosion in documentary. Part of it's driven by the technology. Part of it's driven by this hunger for reality, for the real, that we see even in reality television, as scripted and as phony as that can sometimes be. It still speaks for people's need to see things that are surprising, that reflect kind of the messiness and the loose ends of real life. And I think the third part of the documentary explosion has to do with just trying to sort out a world that is so incredibly dynamic, where there are these great opportunities, but also great perils. and people really trying to suss out, you know, what, you take an inside job, what really happened on Wall Street? You know, what happened with the mortgage-backed securities? You know, or tender stories about, you know, a young kid who, you know, whose father passed away in 9-1-1, you know, mm-hmm. and a small documentary like New York Says Thanks that talks about people taking a caravan from New York to California to donate to things to kids because they were so thankful for the support New York received. So I think there's a real hunger and a real need for that right now. The second thing that we're seeing is really a return to very classic storytelling. While there are lots of people engaged with the technology, you're starting to see people back away from that and trying to tell stories that really matter to people, that really move people emotionally. And I think that that's a great sign, that we're starting to absorb the technology and now be able to use it to tell a range of stories, not just the Transformers 3, although I love those kinds of movies. You know, I look forward to the summer blockbusters every year. But to be able to tell something like The Debt and use technology and special effects in a way that might not even be noticeable, that makes it so much more sophisticated than a film of that sort of genre, of that sort of budget, even maybe 2 years ago.
Oh. It's just so fascinating. Now, Mildred, you're engaged most of the day in, you know, film and digital media, so what kinds of things will get off the topic completely, and what kinds of activities do you like to do? You obviously move between L.A. and Orange County, and, you know, what do you like to do in your kind of like your downtime or other interests?
Well, I have developed a passion for OC restaurants. Right now, I'm in the midst of my boiling crab fetish. They have amazing, amazing Vietnamese Cajun fish. And that's one of the reasons I love the OC is you get all these kind of cultural interchanges that you don't really see in the same way anywhere else. I mean, here are these people who originally these Vietnamese folks, Khmer folks, who came as a result of the boat people in unfortunate circumstances, settled on the Gulf. In the Texas and Louisiana areas, came to California for opportunity and opened this amazing restaurant that starts with the French Creole and the Cajun population and winds up in Tustin and Garden Grove. I mean, not only is it delicious, you know, and I have to give a shout-out to the whole shebang with the lemon pepper, garlic, and Cajun seasoning, but it really speaks to the heart of the OC. So I love exploring restaurants there. I love the beaches. I mean, you know, Huntington Beach, does it get any better than that? And I just love the whole mix that's, you know, that's Southern California. You know, I mean, being able to go to a local town hall in L.A. and hear great speakers and, you know, have a salon, and then being able to go to East L.A. for Day of the Dead. I mean, I think we're incredibly fortunate, you know, to live in a place where all these things are right at our fingertips.
Absolutely. So what's on your agenda for this coming week? Any special activity that you're going to be doing along those lines?
Well, crawfish with a boiling crab. I'm making an apple tart tartan. I went and bought the pan yesterday. For listeners who don't know, it's kind of an upside-down apple tart. My godmother and my aunt are turning 89, and I wanted to do something special for them, so I'm going to attempt this tart tartan. My mind was taken over by the Food Channel. And I'm also going to check out the new exhibit at the Arm & Hammer and just kind of relax with family and friends. I mean, that whole Southern California lifestyle.
Oh, sounds really terrific. So we've just got a couple more minutes, so I'd like our listeners to really know, you know, where to contact you. So if they'd like to, you know, chat or engage you further, where can they find you?
Sure. I mean, I'm available on the Chapman website. If people have questions about Chapman, it's an amazing place that's growing by leaps and bounds. I mean, you know, just think of how small it was, you know, when I first got there, you know, almost over a decade ago now, and to see that we now have Nobel Prize winners as colleagues and the growth in the film school, you know, the incredible, you know, growth in terms of the sciences. It's a great place to be. And they can always contact me if they're interested in just production at mildred@foxlewisproject.com.
Terrific. Well, it's such a pleasure to have Mildred on, and you can hear more of her interesting perspective on story at TEDx SA Artist Village Saturday, October 1st. Tickets are available if you go to that website. But Creative Orange County is also a think tank at the intersection of culture, commerce, and community in Orange County. It's something I launched in late 2010 to engage and inspire Orange County to be a creative community showcase. So I know it's a very ambitious vision, but something that I'm passionate about. And if you'd like more information, you can visit www.creativeorangecounty.com. And so thank you again, Mildred. And until this afternoon, we have another show at 2. So please join us again. And thank you, Mildred, very much.
Thank you, and thank your listeners.